My name's James and I'm an addict.
Hi, James.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Kai, for asking me to do this. I kind of resisted, but I didn't resist because I know why I'm here and I want to be here. And I actually love being here. I love Narcotics Anonymous. I love recovery. And I love the freedom that it's given me. And, first thing, I'll just kind of like air my resentment. All week I've been really thinking, oh my God, it gets recorded here, it's going to go on the internet, it's going to go on CD. No microphone, no speaker, no CD. So I'm not going to be on the internet. How very dare
they? You will.
Oh, okay. Okay, so bigger resentment.
Microphone.
Now I'm back to shitting myself. But what I'd really want to share is how I'm feeling. And I'm feeling a bit, I feel sick. And it's not because of what I'm here for. It's not because of doing the chair. And my adrenaline is starting to rush. And I'm kind of feeling a bit kind of like sick and I'm feeling anxious. But what it's doing is, like, as I'm speaking to you, inside there's this dialogue going on between me and the little boy. The little boy who used to get dragged up in front of the class because the teachers were rather cruel. They knew that I used to just go red if you mentioned my name. They knew that I used to stammer. They knew that I used to get really kind of nervous and I would fall apart in front of everyone. And then that would just be me set up for humiliation for the rest of the day. And that went on through all most of my school days. And the most bonkers thing is that this meeting is like, you know, this is my home group. I'm now going into my third commitment. I know most people here, I know most faces. I feel safe, I feel welcome, I feel loved. But I'm an addict, so it's like, you know, that's kind of like self-obsession at the moment is in full throttle. So I'm trying to just kind of bring myself into the room. But I'm sure there's a lot of identification with that experience of being a kid. So I've got 15 minutes, and it's quite funny, actually. When I do chairs, I always think I'm never going to be able to say anything. And yet, I usually have to end up getting bashed on the head to shut up. So I'm going to kind of like have a watch the clock here. So I'll start from kind of like giving just a little kind of like story about myself, where I'm from. My name's James. I come from Glasgow. I was born in Glasgow. A kind of sort of dysfunctional family, but it was like, you know, the usual kind of story. My mum and dad done the best of their ability. And if I look at my mum now and then, because of being in recovery and what I can actually understand about people, about trauma, about people's past, it's like, you know, my mum, she's got a lot of kind of like, she's got a lot of baggage, she's got a lot of stuff, and she's closed down. And she closed down very, very kind of like, very early into me and my brother and sister's kind of like childhood. And again, I also come from a very kind of rife, riddled with addiction family. You know, one side of the family, it was kind of heroin and alcohol. And then on the other side, it was just mainly alcohol. But it was full-blown addiction. And a lot of people in the family have died from this disease. So as a kid, I think my first awareness of kind of being different was that at a very early age, coming to be aware of why, how, what, when, where, how, when. That was a constant dialogue going through my head. And as a kid, I didn't really understand why I was like that, but it became very, everything was overwhelming. I was very overwhelmed as a kid, and it was constant. It was relentless. And I was also very small. I was a redhead. I looked like a little girl. And I grew up in a kind of Glasgow housing estate, and I have shared this before. And every summer holidays, my mum put me in lederhosen. So I kind of, I was a target. You couldn't miss me. I was this little girl with red hair running around in lederhosen. So I used to get a bit of a hard time. But that didn't make me an addict. Then, also, I was one of these kids that I craved attention, but when I got attention, I didn't know what to do with it. I couldn't handle it. So I was constantly just, as a kid, I was bonkers. I was really totally bonkers. And also, my mum, to calm us down or to keep us quiet, fed us sugar sandwiches. I mean, you know, that explains a lot once again. So I guess possibly sugar was probably my first addiction. And adrenaline was also a thing that I really latched onto very early. I used to get excited by danger. And again, I think most of us, as addicts, we understand that as kids. You're told not to do it, you shove your finger in it. You're told not to eat it, you eat it. You're told not to go there, you go there. I was constantly like that. And I was kind of fearless. And that was kind of really really kind of disturbing. But I didn't really realise that till again I came into recovery and looked back at my past and thought, oh my God, you were totally nuts. You know, normal children don't climb pylons and swing from pylons, you know. You really don't. That kind of stuff. So it was that idea of just getting danger and excitement. And then discovered alcohol, and it was the usual thing. I now know I'm an addict, so I kind of consumed as much as I could possibly keep in my tiny little body until I just projectile vomited it out. But that didn't sort of tell me, it's like, oh, that's not very nice. Went back for more. So that continued. And that kind of basically more or less continued through my teenage years. But there's also a dark part of my childhood. As a kid, I was exposed to sexual and violent abuse. And I'm not comfortable sharing this now, but I can accept it and I can deal with it. And because of how I was and because I craved attention, regardless of the attention, I then manipulated and kind of manoeuvred to go and search out more of that. And so for me, when I discovered alcohol, that was a way of me anaesthetising the fact that I was doing something dirty, filthy, disgusting, humiliating, and it made me so shameful at such a young age. And so I used to just anaesthetise myself to go out for more. And that was my kind of chaos. I also was quite kind of a strange kid because we lived at home, my grandfather, it was his house. So the bedroom that I maybe could have got that he had, I then went to stay with an aunt. And she had no control over me. So I used to, everyone went to bed, it was on the ground floor. I would sneak out 2 o'clock in the morning and I would run around Glasgow. I would run around public toilets. I would run around places where bigger guys were. I get involved in very, very dodgy stuff. And again, I was exposed to some kind of like not very nice things that kids shouldn't get exposed to. Because this time I was about maybe 12, 13 years old. And this went on for a while. And then I got myself involved in some really dodgy characters. So I decided to leave London. I leave Glasgow. And I kind of ran away before I turned 18. I decided to leave. Didn't tell anyone because it was all about me. I just left Glasgow, came to London. And kind of reinvented myself and decided I was going to be Jimmy rather than James. So I kind of became Jimmy. And we talk about geographicals. I kind of done the same thing. I got to London, I had some money. I spent the money. So I basically then just became a male prostitute for a while because I wanted more money. I got a job. I got a job in Debenhams. The money I was getting wasn't enough because I wanted to go clubbing. I wanted clothes. It was all about me. So I used to actually steal from the department store and got sacked. And that was a kind of pattern. It was all about just getting money for me to go clubbing, to buy alcohol. And then I discovered speed. Oh, my goodness, that was just amazing. It was amazing. It really was amazing. And all of my friends' houses were spotless. Spotless. And I used to think that maybe it was like because they liked me. But I still have to work through that one. Maybe I'll ask him about that one day. But I discovered speed. But speed had the most bizarre effect on me because it kind of initially sent me kind of bonkers and crazy, but it had this calming effect on me. I became very sharp. I became very astute and I became very much aware. It seemed to really calm me down and that used to freak everyone else out because everyone else was like, nah, 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 and I'd be just like sitting staring into space. So speed was brilliant for me, but also alcohol was still a part of my story. Full on with the alcohol, not realising, but at that point I was a young alcoholic. It was more or less every day. And I would get to the stage where I would just be working in the department store, going out clubbing, drinking, speed, all that kind of stuff, and then I would burn out. I'd sleep for 3 days and think, oh, that was okay to go back to work kind of like, you know, 4 days later. And this carried on again, and then tried lots of different stuff. Tried heroin, I got into cocaine. Heroin didn't really like because I just kind of like, I don't know, I just didn't do anything. And I was adrenaline fueled. I loved adrenaline, so I just wanted something that was going to set me off on fire. So that didn't really work for me. And then I'll get into coke. And basically, my whole story is that I'd done all of that stuff. I'm trying to watch the clock here so I can get as much as I can into 5 minutes of sections of my story. I get into coke, then it was alcohol. And so I was just trying everything and anything. Again, even as an adult, I was behaving like a juvenile. But unbeknown to me, that's because at certain stages in my childhood, I had closed down. So I was always going to be a child. And I was out of control. I didn't really it's kind of difficult. There was a part of me, it's really strange, because there was a part of me, well, already. I told you, just zooming on. Well, anyway, so basically that was a chaos. Alcohol, drugs. And then I hit a rock bottom. Then I hit a rock bottom and I went into a rehab. And I came out of rehab and I was all clean, I was all healthy and I was all sparkling, but I was off my nut. So I can basically started obsessive compulsive behaviours around lots of other stuff. Then I hit another rock bottom, one more rehab, one more rock bottom. And then my final rock bottom was painful. It was horrendous. It was anything and everything and went on for a long period. But for 2 weeks, I was consuming vast amounts of alcohol, like litre bottles of vodka, pouring in a Benadryl Plus to keep myself awake, and then just kind of meeting with guys because I basically didn't want to be seen to go and get kind of street drugs. So I basically would organise so that I could meet up with bisexual men that would actually have a coke habit that I could then get coke. And so I was still doing all of this. But then this dark week, I was killing myself. I was poisoning myself. I was nearly dying. And my friends could see this. And I have really great friends who are not in recovery who've watched me through decades really just kind of destroy myself. They got me into a treatment centre and I went into a 12-step programme, which I didn't know until I came into a room one morning and it was processed. But, you know, the beautiful thing was I saw the steps on the wall. I saw the Serenity Prayer. None of that language or any of that stuff bothered me because I felt I had come somewhere. I belonged. I didn't understand it, but I felt I'd come somewhere. I belonged because I could sense something and I could feel something from the others. There was something there. And I embraced it. I just embraced it. I didn't care about the language. I realised this is sanctuary. This is refuge and I'm safe. And that's what I kind of grabbed onto. And I started going to meetings. It was a 12-step program, so we had to go to meetings that were in the vicinity. And the first one I went to was CA, and that was quite incredible. I was really scared because I still didn't know what was going on, and I was pinned to the wall in this meeting, and it was a CA meeting. It was all these big guys, and real kind of like, I was kind of like, whoa, this is full on. And then suddenly I heard these men share their stories, and I heard their hearts open, and I heard love. And I heard honesty, I heard vulnerability, and it was the first time I'd experienced anything like that in my life. And I realised, oh my goodness, this is it. I really have come into some kind of door into freedom. And that's what it gave me. It gave me freedom. And ever since that, I've been basically working a programme. I do a lot of service. I do a lot of meetings. I've got a sponsor. I'm working my steps. I'm now on step eight. It's a slow process because I'm 2 years and 7 months into my recovery. But it's my process and it's good for me and it's working. And at the moment, I'm seeing this step as like a step of reconciliation. I'm reaching out to people and being with people that love me and see the change, and all they want from me is to be safe and to live and to be and to have a life. And I'm getting that from this program and from Narcotics Anonymous. I tried other fellowships, but Narcotics Anonymous for me is my fellowship. As they say, it's a one-stop shop, and it's the most radical, revolutionary thing I've ever been involved in my life. The democratic process is beyond compare. It's absolutely, it's incredible. And it fills me every time I come to meetings. And I love coming to meetings and I love recovery. I'm sorry, but I'm evangelical. I'm reclaiming that word. I'm evangelical about my recovery because it's beautiful. It's changed my life. It's given me a life. It's given me a chance to be part of the human experience. There's an expression that's called, we are not human beings on a spiritual journey, we are spiritual beings on a human journey, and I now understand that, but I also have to participate in the human journey, and I can only do that by being in recovery. So if you're new and it's like, you know, a newcomer and you're struggling, keep coming back and see this as a refuge, see this as sanctuary, see this as somewhere where you can come, where you know that that madness, that non-stop dialogue in your head, you can come somewhere and you can share that with people, and you can actually sit with people who will look at you going, yeah, 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 just got a minute. You know, it's like, it really is. And for me, that again is really beautiful because the dialogue in my head doesn't stop. You know, it's like, because it's like, I believe this is a disease also of negativity, and I'm clean and I'm not using, But my head, as soon as I wake up, my head will jump on me to try and get me into a negative arena. And if I'm feeling vulnerable and I'm feeling scared, I can go into that arena. And that becomes very uncomfortable because I feel threatened. So that's when I actually then start to do my meetings. I start to reach out and I get in touch with people. Because if I don't do that, I will isolate. And when I isolate, my disease is on a winner because it knows then that it's just got me and me and me. And then it's all about me. And that's not good because I'm a compulsive obsessive, you know. And at the moment, I'm not kind of like, you know, I'm not using chemical substances. Coffee and GDM. And for anyone who doesn't know, GDM is Great Dark Men. So I'm kind of, that's where I'm at the moment. That's where I'm at the moment. And all I'm going to say is at the moment, I have fab in my life. And that's what I call my, that's what I call my higher power, fab. Faith and belief. And that's what I have on a daily basis. And I get that through this programme. I get that from you. And I've calmed down now, and I'm telling myself, right, time to shut up, time to shut up. Then my little head's sort of going, nah, it's okay, just keep going, keep going. So is that me kind of like,
it's time to shut up.
It's time to shut up. I'll leave it there.